The next case set for argument is Appeal Number 30782, Seamus Culhane et al. Versus Bill Thovesen. Appearing for appellant, Mr. Thovesen, Michael Gust will be arguing, and Mark Schwab is present at council table. Appearing for plaintiff's appellees, Nancy Turbeck-Berry will be arguing, and Chris Angel is at council table. All right, we'll hear from counsel for Mr. Thovesen.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Mike Gust. I'm the lawyer for Bill Thovesen from Fargo, North Dakota. I was admitted pro hoc in the district court. This honorable court has also admitted me pro hoc, and I appreciate you doing so. With me today is my co-counsel, Mark Schwab, on this matter. For the court, and obviously a different setting than normal, just a very brief recap. This matter stems from a contingency fee agreement after Bill Thovesen's wife, Paula, was killed by Dean Yost. Mr. Yost, at the time of the accident, had one arm in a sling. He was texting his father with the other one. He was using narcotics for the pain. He was speeding. He blew through a stop sign. And then his actions caused a T-bone collision where Ms. Thovesen T-boned his vehicle. And the facts of this case with respect to the wrongful death matter are undisputed. And they're undisputed because very early on, and really no work being done, video from a convenience store at the intersection of the accident was discovered by the North Dakota State Highway Patrol. And then the patrol report also included all of the other information I provided you with the state of Mr. Yost at the time of the accident. This case goes well beyond just a standard breach of contract case that the appellees in this matter hope this court limits it to. But the problem with that is in an issue of first impression, I believe in the state of South Dakota, is whether or not lawyers trained in the law, experienced in the law, can contract with lay people and contract away their obligations under the South Dakota codified rules of professional conduct found at SDCL 16-18. Specifically, this case, with respect to the codified rules on professional conduct, deal with my client's ability to determine whether or not he wants to settle a case. In this case, it was undisputed at the district court, and it's been undisputed in the briefings to this court, that the sole reason why the Turbeck Law Firm and the Dixon Law Firm withdrew from representation of my client is because they got what they believed to be a reasonable settlement. He disputed that. He did not want to settle, and informed them that he did not want to settle.
So as we look at it, I mean, the arguments from plaintiff's side is, hey, just apply the contract, legal principles. Contract says we're entitled to withdraw, we get our one-third fee. You're arguing, no, we got to step outside that contract because the rules of professional responsibility, you got to find good cause in order for them to recover any fee, and maybe whether it's a third or a quantum merit, I guess that's another issue. But so I understand both parties' arguments. My question is, you know, and there are states that have addressed this issue, and I understand the reason why states have said, you know, you got to have good cause to withdraw. But typically, good cause and breach of contract, those are questions of fact. I mean, it seems like those cases decide those as a matter of law and just automatically say, you know what, if you withdraw over a fee dispute, attorney is not withdrawn for good cause. Why is that? Why should that determination be different and made as a matter of law versus let's consider the facts of this case and determine whether the attorney did in fact have good cause?
Respectfully, Your Honor, I don't think the facts are really in dispute here to see if they had good cause or not, because in the letter notifying my client of their withdrawal, the only fact that they pointed to is we're withdrawing because you will not settle this case. Under the professional rules of conduct, I have to advise you of X, Y, and Z. I am doing that in this matter. And in conclusion, we're withdrawing because you won't settle this case.
Well, I get a lot different vibe from the brief and from the record as well from the plaintiffs. I think their argument, maybe I'm wrong on this, but I think they're claiming, hey, the client was just trying to reduce the fee. This wasn't about settlement. The client didn't want to settle because the client didn't want to pay the fee that we had negotiated. And isn't that a factual dispute that should be resolved?
It would be a factual dispute, which would not be right for summary judgment. But that's also the post hoc reasoning of the legal counsel. Although a question of first impression in the state of South Dakota, kind of that very issue, Your Honor, was dealt with in the In re Stolman case out of the Minnesota Court of Appeals that we cited to multiple times in our brief. In Stolman, that's exactly what the lawyer tried to do. He wrote a letter to his client at the time of his withdrawal and said, I believe I've gotten you a reasonable settlement. You have chosen not to accept it. I don't think I can get you anything better, and hence I am going to withdraw. Now,
Mr. Gust, can I interrupt you real quick? I'm sorry. So tell me where in Rule 1.16b you're getting this good cause requirement. I mean, I know the catch-all in subsection 7 says other good cause, but there's a number of instances that are specifically enumerated that would justify a lawyer's voluntary withdrawal. And even putting the contract off to the side for a minute, one of them is it can be accomplished without an adverse effect on the client. Didn't prejudice it. Plenty of time left on the statute in this case. Warrants in litigation. Why couldn't Mr. Culhane withdraw?
Well, the facts of the case illustrate that, you know, no prejudice to the client. Well, they essentially threatened him in another email exchange where they said, hey, good luck. We're sticking a lien on this recovery. Good luck going out and trying to find another law firm. But, Your Honor, the question is, they're in the rule that you cited, readily have to admit, it does not talk about good cause. But every single case in the entire country that has looked at this matter, from my research, says if you are withdrawing because your client will not settle, that in and of itself does not constitute good cause, and therefore you're not allowed for it.
Isn't that highly dependent upon the circumstances in which you leave your client? So if you leave your client in a real lurch, I mean, it's in the context of litigation or the 11th hour before the statute runs, or there's some real peril to your client, I understand that. That doesn't seem to be the case here, though. And so the good cause requirement that keeps, you know, running like a refrain here, I'm just really trying to source that. Because ultimately, to analyze your argument, we've got to figure this out. We have a contract, and the law of the state is that the contract is the contract unless it can't be enforced. So, you know, it doesn't have a lawful purpose, violates public policy. That seems to be where this is going, but no one really hits on those principles. So I'm trying to figure out, what's the legal justification to not enforce the contract? Is it public policy? And if that's the case, if it's 1.16b, what in 1.16b is the problem?
I think that was maybe two questions.
It's a lot of questions.
So I'm going to try to go one. Here's the deal with the question about public policy and can we contract away. It is an extremely slippery slope to start saying these are the rules of professional conduct that by entering the bar of the state of South Dakota, you are agreeing to abide by. And then going out into practice, being educated in the law, being experienced in the law, having lay people come into your office and say, this is a contract that we've drafted that we would like you to sign. And as part of that, you are contracting away your client's ability to settle the case as they deem fit.
And I wanted to talk to you about that as well. Is that factually borne out here? I mean, it can be, and it looks like it is, in fact, in some of these cases, maybe more so, but is that really factually borne out here?
Absolutely, 100% uncontradicted. They withdrew for a single reason. that he would not settle the case.
Well, okay.
Anything else is post hoc after the fact.
But that wasn't what you said before. You said that they were somehow interfering, I'm paraphrasing, interfering with his right to make that decision. The fee agreement and the email from Mr. Culhane said or exactly the opposite. You can do, and or maybe it was a deposition testimony, you can do whatever you want vis-a-vis this settlement, but I don't have to be your lawyer. And then factually, as things ultimately played out, the client took exactly the same offer that was on the table at the time of withdrawal. There wasn't a lift. There was no different number. So the advice, would you grudgingly admit, the advice seems to be, if the advice was, hey, I don't think there's any more money, I think this is good, it's going to get. The proof ultimately was in the pudding on that, or not?
I would not necessarily agree with that. You have a situation where, let me take a step back into the facts of this case. His wife is killed on July 28th. On August 4th of 2020, he meets with Mr. Culhane. 8 days later, on August 12th, the insurance company has been advised of his representation, and he gets an email saying, I don't have consent to my client yet, but I think we can get this wrapped up in short order. And then on October 7th, as we pointed to in our brief, there's an email exchange between Mr. Culhane and Mr. Dixon that says, hey, I don't want to take this case to trial. Okay? So now, from that point forward, they start attempting to tell Mr. Thofson, hey, you got to settle this case. They have email exchanges that's in the record that say, the end of this case is now here. And instead of advocating for Mr. Thofson and checking other avenues of recovery, they start telling him, hey, we have to do this. And my client pushes back and says, well, wait a minute. What about all these other things that we can look at? Did they do it? Maybe. Was it half-heartedly? Absolutely. They had in discovery and at the deposition, they had any number of ways to discover assets of individuals, nothing that they did. In fact, Mr. Dixon's analysis was, you know what, I was having to drive by it anyway, so I do buy his farmstead. Just doesn't look like a very nice one to me, so I just don't think that he has a whole lot of money. So to going back to your prior question, though, Justice Salter, where's the slippery slope? Where does it stop? If we can contract away our obligation to the professional rules that it is the client's ability to settle the case, well, all right, hey, you know what? I'm going to contract with you. If I have to withdraw because I don't think what you're doing is reasonable, which is the essence of this case, I'm going to waive the attorney-client privilege. And by signing my contract, you are allowing me to waive the attorney-client privilege. So anything you tell me while I represent you is protected. But via our contract, when I withdraw because I don't think you're being reasonable in this action, I can then no longer be held to the obligation of the attorney-client privilege, and I can talk to anybody about the case that you and I have discussed. So where does it end? If we can breach one professional rule of conduct via contract, where does it end?
I don't think you got to the question that he asked, which was, did they recover anything additional? Did the client recover anything additional beyond what they had recovered for him or had been recovered in the offer that they made prior to their withdrawal?
He did not. But here's the thing. In every single case that has looked at it, and it's just screaming out in the appellee's brief, because in the district court and before this case, they have not cited a single case to the contrary that stands for a different proposition.
Okay, so if we follow the direction taken by Minnesota and Montana, how do we strike the balance between protecting the client's right to make the settlement decisions and ensuring that attorneys receive fair compensation for their services?
That's done at the contracting table. And that's where I think universally, whether it be a 33% under these circumstances, 35% under these circumstances, or 40% under these circumstances, that is done. But universally, if you have every right to withdraw, I'm not saying that you cannot withdraw, but what I am saying that if you withdraw and you don't have it without good cause, which is what is universally held when you withdraw because your client won't settle, then you're not entitled to your contingency
fee. My concern is determining that as a matter of law, because the situation is, sure, has the attorney put the client in a difficult position because the client says, I'm not ready to settle, I'm not comfortable, even though we've got policy limits, it doesn't appear to be other insurance, maybe other assets, I want to proceed, I want to keep looking at this. So you've got that situation, and then the attorney says, well, I'm going to withdraw. I mean, what lawyer is going to touch at that point in time, what lawyer is going to touch that client and say, hey, they got a one-third lien on you? I can't help you because I can't take this on a contingent fee basis. So you've got that. But on the other hand, the client can hold the lawyer hostage by saying, you know what, I've got an absolute right to decide if I want to settle. I don't care how unreasonable I am in my position. Why wouldn't we determine that good cause on a factual, let the parties come in and give their testimony and then make a decision of whether or not there's a good cause for the lawyer to have withdrawn and get a fee.
And along those lines, Justice Jensen, we had affidavits before the district court where both my client and his daughter, who was present at the meeting with Seamus Culhane, the attorney from Turbic Law, they told him out of the gate, I can pay you on an hourly basis. This is not about the money. My wife was killed. My daughter no longer has her mother. I no longer have my wife. This is about taking this case and holding Dino's responsible.
But those are all facts.
Those are factual questions.
Those are all facts that maybe should be presented at a trial.
Yeah, and the district court prevented us from having that opportunity. I see that my time is up, but I'll address any questions, everybody.
Thank you. All right, Ms. Turbeck-Berry, you can proceed with argument.
Good morning, Your Honors. Thank you for the opportunity to be with you today. This is, plain and simple, a contract case. And what Mr. Thufson's counsel wants to ignore, of course, is the contract. But it's not just the general law of contracts, Justice Salter, that governs here. We have a specific contract, 151738, that says the compensation of attorneys for services rendered in civil actions is left to the agreement of the parties. Now, there's nothing invalid about the contract here. They have not cited one single case that says such a contract is invalid.
But they have cited cases from around the whole jurisdiction talking about the majority rule that an attorney can't withdraw solely for the reason that the client would not accept a settlement decision.
Justice Kern, you're absolutely right. The rule is you have to have good cause to withdraw.
You didn't plead good cause. You pled a deck action, an attorney lien, and a breach of contract. You didn't plead good cause. You didn't plead quantum merit, a right to recovery. And so I'd like to hear your response to that.
Sure. Well, my first response is this was not a motion for permission to withdraw, so the issue of good cause wasn't there. But the second point is there can be probably no better good cause than a contractual term that a party agreed to. That is the good cause. And not a single case that the appellant relies on involved a situation where there was a contract. And in fact, one of the cases that they cite, the Fifth Circuit case, specifically suggests that the way attorneys should protect themselves is by limiting their scope of representation at the outset. Now, that is not only authorized by or suggested by the Fifth Circuit, it's expressly authorized in the rules of professional conduct. And I'm kind of happy to be talking about those rules, even though they don't, I think, as we all know, they don't actually govern the legal obligations, but they are important, and they're important to the lawyers in this case. But the Rule 1.2 expressly says you can limit the scope of representation, and that's what was done here. And it was done in a contract with a very sophisticated client, a man who does business negotiating and drafting contracts, who had lots of litigation experience, something like 20 cases in the prior 12 years. So
those are facts. We've got to determine a rule in this case. Do we apply just a straight contract? You know, this is what the fee agreement says, and we're going to apply that? Or do we apply this good cause standard that a lot of courts have done? And then if we do that, how do we determine that? Is it a matter of law or is it a fact question?
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, I think precisely what you have to decide is, did Judge Hoffman err in granting summary judgment in saying undisputed evidence proved there was a breach of contract?
We can't, in my view, well, I don't know. We'll see what happens. I'm still figuring it out. But it seems like it's difficult to step over the contract right into the rules. The contract is significant. And so if we're going to get to the rules or we're going to get to just cause or 1.16 or any of that, it seems like we have to deal with the contract. And if dealing with the contract is a euphemism under the topside argument, for not enforcing, okay, we have to have a legal justification for not enforcing something that otherwise seems like a regular contract.
Thank you, Your Honor, and you said a lot better than
what
I should have, which is there is no authority to say that a contract like this is invalid. None. They haven't cited
a
single case.
What do you do when there's a conflict of interest that arises? So client says, and this is not the first time, this happens all the time. Client says, I don't want to settle. Lawyer says, you need to settle. This is a really good offer. You're not going to get a better deal. Client says, or maybe the client says, well, okay, I'll take it if you cut my fee. Or maybe the lawyer says, you know what, I don't have the time to try this case. It's too, you know, so there's all these competing interests that are going on, and sometimes it works fine, and these contention, and many times it does, but sometimes it doesn't. And then lawyers and clients have to figure those out, but it puts the client and the attorney in a really difficult conflict situation in some of these, and I would suggest in maybe this case. So then... At what point in time do our rules of professional responsibility say, okay, how do we address a situation like that? Do we just apply the contract when the contract says the client still has the right to determine settlement and the attorney says, nope, you need to settle? And so who wins? How do we resolve that?
Well, excuse me, Your Honor, but this contract did not take away the right to decide whether to settle or not. It simply said if you are unreasonable in your decision, and after all, let's talk about the unreasonableness here. We're in COVID. Nobody's scheduling trials. We've got the maximum recovery that can possibly be obtained. And we have a client who appears to be just resisting for the purpose of trying to negotiate still further fee reductions. So that's what we've got here. But he still had and exercised the right to decide whether or not to settle. The issue wasn't that. The issue was, can an attorney limit their scope of representation by contract, like Rule 102 of the professional rules say, and in this case, that was done. Our representation is going to go to until it could go the whole nine yards, but if you refuse to accept a reasonable settlement offer, we can withdraw. That would be the end of our representation at that point. That was the contract limitation.
So you get to conclude what's reasonable. I mean, isn't that a question of fact?
I think that's... Actually, if I were sitting on that side of the table, I would say, well, is it fair that the contract said reasonable in the discretion of the lawyer? Maybe if I were making the rule, I'd say a reasonable offer, objectively. In this case, that's a theoretical distinction only, because clearly it was reasonable. So if you had... it's kind of hard to understand why a lawyer would ever do this, given the financial incentives in a contingency fee agreement. But if you had a lawyer saying this is a reasonable offer when it clearly is not, I might take a case against that.
And I was driving at that a little bit with some of my earlier questions. So in this case anyway, and I understand it could be maybe a closer call in a case where similar circumstances, the client goes out, engages other counsel, and there's a big lift once the case is resolved by trial or by negotiated settlement. That didn't happen here. So would there even be a fact question about reasonableness if ultimately the same amount that was on the table at the time Mr. Culhane withdrew is ultimately the amount that's accepted?
Well, I think although consistent with the lack of a requirement for findings, Judge Hoffman didn't enter specific findings. But if you read the lengthy hearing transcript, in a sense, he did find that it was objectively reasonable, because nothing more was ever gotten. The client had a year and a half yet that they could have initiated litigation, taken it to trial. The client hired two lawyers to sue to try to avoid the fee, but nobody, neither the client, who incidentally was a professional credit collector who participated in determining there were no other resources, neither the client nor his subsequent lawyers nor anybody else ever came up with anything else. So in light of the fact that there was no more to be had, and in fact there would be considerable delay and substantial additional costs, the settlement offer was not only reasonable, it was the best thing that could happen for this
client.
So
I want to go back to your comment. You said, okay, so if it was a situation where the lawyer says, you know what, you should settle, and yeah, you probably could get more money, but I don't want to, I got a good fee here, so I'm just going to I'm going to take it and run. You need to settle. Client doesn't settle. So kind of that slippery slope argument Mr. Gus is talking about. You said, I take that case for the client. I think you made that reference. And so my question is, if we just create this as a straight contract situation, attorney can always withdraw. They get their one-third fee. If there's a dispute on the fee and whether they settle or not, if we create that as an absolute rule in every case, you're going to have some situations where maybe that rule doesn't work very well.
I don't think you have to make it an absolute rule in every case, and I don't think this litigation is asking you to make that rule in every case. It's asking you in this case, was there anything that makes this contract unenforceable? And the answer to that is no. The alternative is, and as the Fifth Circuit Court mentioned, you know, when they suggested that how do lawyers protect themselves otherwise from unreasonable clients? And the Fifth Circuit said, contract at the front end. And Rule 1.2 says, limit the scope of your representation. Because the alternative is, if the court's never willing to enforce a contract that similar to this, although perhaps with a good modification that it's an objectively reasonable settlement, fair enough. But if the court's not willing to enforce any of those contracts, then frankly, the contingency-free practice goes away. Because every single client could get to the point where the settlement offer's on the table, but they refuse to sign the release. The lawyer can't make your client settle. I know that. And so, well, I'll settle if you reduce your fee. I'll settle if you do nothing. I want you to waive your fee entirely. Contingency fee practice, and it's not for the faint of heart, is really important for people to get access to legal services. And it's not true in this case, incidentally, that even this client wanted to pay an hourly fee. But most people can't. So you need to have a contingency fee practice. But if you disable the lawyer and say, you can work, as these guys did, you can work 5 months, get the maximum a client can get, have it on the table, explain why it's good, and yet you're out, you don't get anything. Well, we'll all go back to doing divorces and DWIs. I mean, there's no protection for the lawyer if you won't enforce a limiting an attorney's right to limit by contract. And there was a lot of reason to be suspicious in this case that this client needed to be limited by contract. I mean, this wasn't the first time he'd walked into the law office. He'd been turned away twice before, and he had litigated against everybody and his uncle. And so, to find that there's something unconscionable or unreasonable about this contract is just not borne out. He got excellent service. He got the best result anybody could ever or did ever get for him. And what this really comes down to, and I think it was Justice Salter said, what this is really about is a client that doesn't want to pay. And I would respectfully disagree with you, Chief Justice, if I heard you say this happens a lot. It doesn't. In 35 plus years of exclusive practice, virtually never. Now, I hope South Dakota doesn't change so much that we're like the rest of the country, and maybe it does. But it generally doesn't. This is not a common occurrence.
Well, I would agree with you that this case in front of us is not a common occurrence, but I think it's more frequent than not that clients and lawyers may sometimes get crosswise on let's resolve fees and resolve cases and whether we want to settle. I mean, that's, and my point is they normally don't get to this point.
True, and I suspect, this is maybe a better conversation informally, but I suspect, especially if you're dealing with lawyers who are not particularly good at what they do, and are more concerned with running some sort of a billboard practice where they churn them through and they never try cases. Clearly, that's not what the situation was here. These are lawyers that go to the mats for their clients if there's anything more they can do for them. So I think you're right, and that's a whole different problem with the practice of law and some people getting into contingency fee practices for the wrong reason.
So the hard question is whether or not the rules of professional responsibility can yield to a contractual provision. Other than this Fifth Circuit case, are you aware of any other authority? I mean, you've looked at the majority jurisdiction rule here. Other than the Fifth Circuit case that references the contract, is there any other authority that you would point the court to in grappling with this issue?
But, Your Honor, I'm not sure I understand your question. Are you saying, because you're saying the rule referring to withdrawing for good cause?
Yes.
Okay. Well, no, I don't think there's any opinions at all other than the Fifth Circuit is the only one that suggests a contract, and none of them, perhaps no cases where there was a contract ever came to the courts. I don't know. But the issue is that, I mean, good cause is defined in Black's Law Dictionary as, you know, a valid, I think it's a substantial reason for a legal excuse. And again, I don't know what could be a better good cause than a contractual term. And let's not forget there's other rules of professional conduct involved here, too. I mean, if we want to look at that part of the book for a while, I mean, there are the rules of professional conduct were painstakingly adhered to, starting with, boy, we're going to have a fee split. We got to have it in writing. Rule 3.1 says you cannot proceed with a legal proceeding on a frivolous basis. And there appeared to be nothing other than a frivolous basis in this case once everything was on the table. Rule 4.4a says you cannot use means that have no substantial purpose other than to embarrass, delay, or burden a third party. So the rules themselves, I believe, impose on trial lawyers the duty to make the kind of reasoned judgment that the lawyers here made. I mean, you can't just look at one phrase in one rule. The whole body of the rules would seem to support greatly what these lawyers did, and to focus on good cause. I mean,
Your time is up.
My point, and I'm sticking to it, is a contract well negotiated is good cause.
Thank you. Mr. Guss, you may proceed with rebuttal.
May it please the court, I'd like to pick up where counsel left off. Under the rules that you can't bring a frivolous action. So let's talk about the facts of this case. They brought Thomas Dixon in because it was a North Dakota case. Accident happened in North Dakota. All the evidence is in North Dakota. The attorney Lean says that it's going to be a North Dakota case. And at his deposition, Mr. Colhane says, I got Tom Dixon because he's a bulldog. This is one bad man, and insurance companies hate him. And you know why I know that? Because he got a $1 billion judgment in a traffic accident case of a gentleman going the wrong way down the interstate after drinking all day long. He didn't take that to trial once. He didn't take it back to trial twice. They've been up and down at the North Dakota Supreme Court in the Morissette case, and he testified at his deposition. Right away they gave us policy limits, but we wanted to go to trial because my co-counsel wanted a $1 billion judgment. So to come here today and say, we don't take frivolous cases, if this is frivolous because of that, then the Morissette case is the same. The court addressed that at the district court, and we pointed it out to him. The judge was like, oh, never mind. That's a North Dakota case, and it's not binding here. With respect to the contract, with this idea that there's a limitation of representation is completely erroneous. The contract said, out of every claim that you have for the death of your wife stemming from this auto accident, we represent you and we get paid for it. They didn't limit their representation at all. They said every single claim that arises out of this, we will represent you on. And only when they got this deal that they decided would be reasonable, and I want to pick up where Justice Jensen had queried counsel on, we said, well, you know what? What if I no longer have enough time? You know, I no longer am interested in your case. Well, the balance of power now between the lawyer and the client is, you know what, I'm going to take your case as long as I can get it off my plate quickly and make a large sum of money in a quick fashion on a contingency fee basis. But you know what, if it goes a little bit longer than I suspected it will, or that I expected, or that I want to, well, then I'm just going to withdraw. The balance power between lawyer and client then is completely one-sided, and the lawyer gets to decide everything about the representation, including whether it's going to be settled or not, because I'm no longer interested. And if I'm no longer interested and I withdraw, you still have to pay me.
But some of those questions and some of these scenarios, and I appreciate the conversation, the chief hit upon some of these as well. I suppose we could really conceive of a lot of different scenarios, and it's good to think about them, but In this case, it didn't happen that way. The amount of money that was offered was the only amount of money that was ever recovered in this case. The fee agreement said we get paid, you know, this percentage, which, by the way, was, of course, negotiated. And so why is this case like any of those scenarios where a lawyer acts unscrupulously or does something that really does seem sort of suspect? It doesn't seem like any of that is going on here because your client didn't go out, engage somebody, do a lot better, and then factually come in and say, we got left in a huge lurch, and when we cleaned everything up, we did much better. That just didn't happen.
With all due respect, Justice Salter, the decision of whether or not I withdraw for good cause is irrelevant, and it's not based on what's going to happen in the future with my case. The question of whether I withdrew for good cause is based upon the facts up until the date of my withdrawal. Now, in North Dakota, cases are good for 10 years, and you can renew a judgment for 10 years. Dean Yost and Charles Yost were both in this lawsuit, Charles being the father, Dean being the son. Dean is a young man. We have no idea what would have happened had an actual lawsuit been filed. They put some pressure on these people. In fact, the record is clear that Mr. Dixon, when he is saying, hey, you know what, Mr. Allen, who's representing one of the Yostes, can I just talk to your client? I got a really difficult client down in South Dakota. We just want to get this done. But to Justice Jensen's point, all of that is questions of fact to determine whether or not this was a reasonable withdrawal. And my understanding is that the question of reasonableness when we have disputed facts is always going to be a question of fact for the fact finder to decide. And because we were not given that right and the district court kicked us on summary judgment, we respectfully believe that this court should remand the case. However, it should be remanded with instructions that no good cause existed and the Turbick and Dixon law firm are not entitled to a contingency fee in this case. If the court's not willing to adopt the rules of, I believe, literally every single case or court in the country that has looked at that, then we have a fact question that needs to be decided. Thank you.
Have you found cases in your research, other than the Fifth Circuit case, in which there was a contractual provision like the one here allowing for withdrawal?
No.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, for your arguments.